Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday the 16th of May, these are our main stories. Ukraine says its air defence systems were effective against Russia's very heavy overnight attack on Kyiv. Censorship in Hong Kong as the authorities remove political books from its libraries, including those on Tiananmen Square. A film from Sudan is part of the official Cannes Film Festival for the first time. We meet the makers. Also in this podcast, what happened to the missing birds? A new study points to intensive farming as the main culprit for 550 million fewer birds in Europe over the last 40 years.
There have been massive declines, and the loss is huge. It's really a real wake-up call for us to act now, and we must act to do something different.
And the audacious multi-billion dollar jewellery heist in Dresden. Five men are found guilty. We start in the Ukrainian capital Kyiv, which underwent heavy bombardment by Russia overnight. Officials there called the attack exceptional in its density, with 18 missiles fired in a short space of time. A spokesman from the Russian Defense Ministry, Igor Konashenkov, claimed that all of its military objectives had been achieved.
Last night, the armed forces of the Russian Federation launched a concentrated strike with high-precision, long-range air and sea-based weapons at the locations of Ukraine's army units, as well as storage sites for ammunition, weapons and military equipment supplied by Western countries. The target of the strike has been achieved. All assigned targets have been hit.
But that's not how Ukraine sees it. The military there says its air defences had achieved unbelievable success, shooting down all 18 attacks, including six of Russia's most advanced hypersonic missiles. I heard more about Ukraine's defence systems from our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bechega.
They're saying that they shot down all 18 missiles that had been launched by Russia during this latest wave of airstrikes. And I think what is significant here is that they're claiming to have destroyed six hypersonic missiles. Now, if confirmed, this shows how Ukraine can now destroy one of the most sophisticated conventional weapons in Russia's arsenal. This attack was different. It was intense. We heard several extremely loud explosions here in Kyiv. We even saw how the air defense systems intercepted the missiles over the city. So it was extremely intense here for all of us. And again, the eighth time this month that Kyiv came under attack. And we had some reaction from Moscow, because the Russian defense minister is claiming that he had successfully hit one of those air defense systems, the US-made Patriot air defense system, something that hasn't been confirmed by the Ukrainian authorities. But again, Kyiv coming under intense attack at night.
And do you think this intense attack was because President Zelensky has just been to Europe and acquired billions of dollars worth of military support there?
I think, honestly, these attacks have been so frequent that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to link any specific event to these attacks. Again, it was the eighth time this month that Kyiv came under attack. What the authorities here have been saying is that the Russian strategy seems to be trying to exhaust the air defense systems and even try to destroy these systems that have been extremely important in protecting towns and cities across the country from these relentless Russian airstrikes. And I think during this visit by President Zelensky, he received the promise that billions of pounds, billions of dollars worth of military aid will be sent to Ukraine, and including a package by the UK with attack drones and the vital air defence missiles.
Hugo Bechega in Kyiv. The number of birds in Europe has plummeted drastically over the last 40 years. There are now 550 million fewer flying over the continent. Research from 28 countries found the number of wild birds has dropped by more than a quarter. But farmland species, including swifts and yellow wagtails, have been hardest hit. The cause? Pesticides and fertilizers, which are used in intensive farming. Richard Gregory, a professor of biodiversity, is at the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds.
This study looked at kind of four potential smoking guns here as to what's driving the change in these bird populations and other nature. And it came out very, very strongly with the dominant factor being those changes in agricultural practices. And particularly the thing that we were able to measure there was the high input of pesticides and fertilisers. We looked at these farmland birds and other birds right across Europe. Over 80% of them are feeding their young or feeding themselves on an invertebrate type diet. And of course, pesticides and fertilizers are removing those invertebrates, the insects, from the environment, particularly the farmed environment, which is being used so strongly now and in such an intensive fashion. So that means the birds really don't have the food there to feed themselves, sustain themselves. And that's why year on year we're seeing these quite worrying and important declines of these bird populations.
Give us a couple of examples.
Birds like the grey partridge, a bird that you can see in the UK, across Europe, 92% decline. The windchat, 90% decline in the population over 40 years. Turtle dove, 85%. Corn bunting, 77%. Yellow wagtail, 69%. And I could go on, skylark, 67%. There have been massive declines, particularly in this suite of birds specialising on farmland landscapes. And the loss is huge. It's a real wake-up call for us to act now, and we must act to do something different.
What do you think must be done?
We need to incentivize and help and support farmers doing the right things to bring back wildlife-rich habitats, nature-friendly farming, flower-rich margins. We know how to do this and really move away from this reliance on fertilizers and particularly pesticides in the environment, because they're having wide impacts upon the watercourses and nature reserves around farmland and woodlands. You know, it's a real pervasive effect. And many farmers are doing the real right thing, so it's about supporting them.
And I suppose birds one day and other species in the ecosystem tomorrow.
There's strong evidence to suggest that invertebrate populations, insect populations, insectageddon is talked about. You know, we strongly suspect very strong declines in insects, certainly moths and butterflies and other insect groups like the pollinators that are going to be so important to the food production. So, you know, kind of supporting nature-friendly farming, it's good for nature, it's good for farmers, it's good for consumers and the environment, for climate. You know, there's no bad side to it. It's all good, really, and we should be doing that to live in a more sustainable way moving forward. The biggest threat to food production output comes in, a UK government report tells us that recently, that food security is strongly contingent on biodiversity loss and climate change. They're the big threats to food security in the medium to long term. So we should be doing this.
Professor Richard Gregory. The mother of jailed Kremlin critic Vladimir Karamurza has told the BBC his spirit is unbroken, despite being sent to prison for 25 years. Mr. Karamurza, a Russian activist who also holds British citizenship, is one of President Putin's most vocal critics. He was convicted last month of a string of alleged crimes, including treason. His mother, Yelena Gordon, has been to see him in jail in Moscow, and she told the BBC's Russia editor Steve Rosenberg how her son is holding up behind bars.
He's brave, obviously. His spirit is unbroken. I'm worried about his health.
You say his spirit is unbroken.
His spirit is unbroken. He is surprisingly optimistic. He believes in the future of Russia. He believes in his own role in this future democratic Russia. In terms of his own immediate future, he is realistic. He's getting ready to be transferred to a penal colony.
Vladimir must have known last year when he came back to Russia, and you must have known, that he was putting himself in a lot of danger by returning to Russia as a big critic of Vladimir Putin and someone who was instrumental in pushing Western governments to introduce sanctions on corrupt officials. Did you try to stop him last year coming back?
I did. I did, because it's a very painful topic for me as a mother. Because I'm, first of all, I'm his mother, I must say. I cannot distance myself and see him as a political figure only. He's first and utmost a son for me, my son. And I begged him not to go back to Russia. He didn't promise. He said he promised to think about this. And as you say, the result of his thinking was negative.
Has he expressed any regret to you that he returned?
No, never. Never. I regret it very much. I can speak for myself. Yeah?
Does he feel, and do you feel, support from people around you? Or, on the contrary, do you feel that a lot of people in this country don't care about Vladimir's fate?
Speaking for myself, I personally feel a great support, but it all comes from the circle of my friends, family, distant friends. For instance, this time after the trial, I received messages from people I haven't seen literally for half a century, ex-classmates whom I never ever saw after our school days. I must say that since my son started his political activity, or rather after the 2014, I personally also lost two friends because they don't want to have to do with me because of my son, which is very upsetting. As for the people, I would say that not many people know about the case.
What does this tell us, Yelena, about what is happening in Russia, to Russia right now, the direction in which this country is moving?
Yeah, I'm afraid Russia has turned into dictatorship. And it is, to me, it all looks rather grotesque, actually, that in the 21st century, we see around us what was described in the anti-utopias of the 20th century. It's a regress. It's a terrible regress. It's a shame.
Yelena Gordon. In Hong Kong, public libraries have pulled from their shelves most political books and documentaries, including those relating to the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. The move was announced by the territory's leader, John Lee. Our Asia Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, told us more.
The background to this story, first of all, is that over a period of time, people have noticed that material, including books and archive documentation, has been disappearing from public libraries in Hong Kong. Stuff which might have been critical of the Chinese government in Beijing. And so just a couple of days ago, a newspaper in Hong Kong, the South China Morning Post, decided to look and see if it could find any material related to the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, the anniversary for which is due in a couple of weeks' time. And it couldn't find any material. Now, it's been difficult up to now to work out what the government in Hong Kong has been doing. But at a press conference, the leader of Hong Kong, John Lee, was challenged on this. And he admitted that books and other material had been taken out of libraries. This is what he had to say.
These books are accessible by people in private bookshops. If they want to buy, then they can buy. What libraries need to do is ensure that books that may not be suitable for circulation, that they have to do their duties, ensure that there is no breach of any laws in Hong Kong, and also if they spread any kind of messages that are not in the interest of Hong Kong.
John Lee and Michael, what do you think this tells us about what is going on in Hong Kong in the long term?
I mean, this is just another example of the curtailing of free speech in Hong Kong. Already over the last few years, we've had opposition legislators banned from standing in the local assembly. Meaningful protests have ended. Newspapers which were critical of the government in Beijing have been closed down. Now, even factual information about real events which took place in China have been taken off the shelves of Hong Kong libraries. Essentially, Hong Kong is being turned into just another mainland Chinese city under the complete control of the Chinese Communist Party.
And do you think this is making dissent practically impossible?
It's difficult to see now how any
meaningful dissent can be organised in Hong Kong. Of course, the authorities there will maintain this kind of fig leaf, this idea that Hong Kong is still free, open and vibrant. But really, in terms of political speech, there's not much allowed at the moment.
Michael Bristow. Still to come, the campaign of online abuse against high-profile Chinese women in the West.
I'm being trolled daily with really vicious messages. You know, it doesn't matter that a bot is telling me to go kill myself. It still has an effect on my psyche. They are trying to use their power to mute me.
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. This next story could have been lifted straight from the plot of a Hollywood film. 4 years ago, jewellery valued at more than $100 million was stolen from a museum in the German city of Dresden. Today, five men were found guilty of the heist. Our Berlin correspondent, Jenny Hill, spoke to us from outside the Green Vault Museum where the jewellery was stolen.
It was a crime so brazen and audacious that it really shocked the art world and left a lot of people here thinking, how on earth did they pull this off? The gang had really planned this meticulously. They'd recce'd the site several times and they actually prepared their entry point well in advance. It sounds staggering, but they were able to use hydraulic cutting machinery to saw through the bars over a window, which they then taped back up so it looked like there was nothing wrong. And they left it like that until they were ready to strike. And at that point, in the early hours of a November morning, they set fire to an electrical circuit breaker box nearby. That plunged the surrounding streets into complete darkness, allowing the men to slip inside. Two of them went in, wearing masks, wielding axes, and smashed the glass display cases, which held this glittering treasure trove of items, and allowing them to get away with millions and millions of dollars worth of really 18th century, some would say irreplaceable, jewellery and other diamond-encrusted items.
Well, you say a glittering treasure trove, but a lot of it hasn't been recovered, has it? What's happened to it? Do we know?
Yeah. Yes, we do. Some of the items have been replaced. And actually, I spoke to the director of the collection yesterday. She said, actually, the majority of it we now have back at the museum. It was in a pretty nasty condition when it came back, and experts are now working on its restoration. It'll be some time before it can go back on public display. Now, the reason some of it came back is because one of the men had actually confessed, three of the men actually had confessed to the theft during the course of the trial. They struck a deal with prosecutors saying, look, we'll tell you where we've stashed some of the loot in return for the promise of a slightly lighter sentence. That's how police were able to recover some of the jewellery. But there are still some items missing, and actually curators here think it's pretty unlikely they'll ever be returned. It's probably worth making the point, the director of the collection said that these items were amassed by a man called Augustus the Strong back in the 18th century. He actually designed the so-called Green Vault, in which they were still displayed today. His plan was that this glittering display should be viewed by visitors as a whole in its entirety. It would overwhelm the visitor, he thought. That was the concept here still today. But the fact that some of those jewels may never come back means it will essentially probably never be whole again.
Jenny Hill. Researchers say they have evidence that high-profile Asian women are being targeted by trolls on the internet. It seems the abuse originates in China and may be sponsored by a powerful political force. One of the victims is Jiayang Fan, a staff writer with the New Yorker magazine, and she told Sam Judah about her ordeal.
I grew up in Chongqing, China, until the age of 7, and I am a U.S. citizen right now.
Jiayang Fan moved to the US with her mother when she was a child and became her carer when she developed motor neuron disease. When the pandemic struck, lockdown restrictions threatened to leave her mother without the help she needed.
I took to Twitter to plead for my mother's medical care in the midst of the pandemic.
In desperation, Jiang Fan tweeted a picture of her mother with a plea asking the authorities to allow specialist carers to remain in post. The request was granted, but online, things got weird. Trolls targeted Jiang Fan with extreme Chinese nationalist rhetoric.
Dog trader Jiang Fan calling me someone who eats the ashes of her mother, who is not even fit to be fed to the pigs. There's something almost heartbreakingly crude about that dehumanization.
It's not completely clear why Jiang Fan was being targeted, but the trolling didn't stop when her mother passed away in January last year.
The volume was surprising to me. It was incessant.
And she noticed something unusual about many of the accounts in question.
The faces associated with their Twitter accounts, they're always white with very American names like Tracy Smith or, you know, John Brown. That's when I noticed that they seemed to be coordinated and seemed to be bots.
Bots spewing coordinated abuse. To try and understand what was happening, we turned to Albert Zhang, an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ASPI for short. He's developed a hypothesis about this phenomenon.
So the headline of the story really is that the Chinese Communist Party is seeking to silence women of Chinese descent, both to censor their critical reporting, but also to control how China is portrayed to the rest of the world.
That idea is at the heart of Albert's research. For now, he sees it as a likelihood, not a certainty.
We actually have no evidence to tie these social media accounts directly to the Chinese government.
ASPI are making their inferences based on patterns they've drawn from the data. A lot of the accounts have Western names and photos, but most of their posts are made during Beijing business hours. The Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C. didn't respond to our question about Albert's theory that the CCP might be behind the trolling of Asian women. For Jiang Fan, the source of the abuse doesn't change how she feels.
I'm being trolled daily with really vicious messages. You know, it doesn't matter that a bot is telling me to go kill myself. They are trying to use their power to mute me. And that is a dynamic that, as a journalist, as a human, I very much want to resist.
New Yorker magazine writer Jiang Fan. The Cannes Film Festival is getting underway in the south of France with the usual mix of glamour, star power and fame. For one team of filmmakers, it was to have been a triumph on a world stage for their movie. But that moment in the sun now contrasts with the chaos in their homeland of Sudan. Their film, Goodbye Julia, is the first from Sudan ever to be shown in the festival's official selection. But celebrations for the makers are now overshadowed by the violent conflict in their country. Tom Brooks reports from Cannes.
Thank you for flying today. I wish you a pleasant night here in Nice and surroundings, as well as a safe onward journey.
By the plane load, film stars, producers, agents, journalists, filmmakers and assorted others are arriving on the French Riviera for the Cannes Film Festival. Most are buoyant in mood, but that's not how it is for Mohamed Kordofani from Khartoum, an aviation engineer turned filmmaker who has directed Goodbye Julia, the first film from Sudan ever to make it into the official selection in Cannes. The movie is a relationship drama set in Khartoum before South Sudan gained independence in 2011. Its presence in Cannes is seen as a pivotal moment, a big move forward for Sudan's filmmaking community. But with Sudan in turmoil, director Mohamed Kordofani told me he felt torn.
It is a bittersweet feeling, to be honest, because as I walk the red carpet, I know that people are fleeing their homes and trying to get to safety. So it's definitely a bittersweet feeling. On the other hand, I know that this brings attention to what's going on in Sudan and in some ways can help.
Dr. Erdogan?
I don't know, but I know.
The film focuses on the story of two Sudanese women from very different backgrounds, one a northerner, the other a southerner. It reveals how racism has shaped their lives. It's a story of reconciliation. The film doesn't have a direct bearing on the current conflict, but the director hopes his portrayals will shed light on the human beings caught up in all the mayhem.
If this film can allow people to see past the smoke and the bombing and just see the people, I think that emotional and humane connection matters more than any political views. So that's really what I'm hoping out of screening this film in Cannes.
Another Sudanese movie, Al Sitt, a short film made 4 years ago, which explores an arranged marriage in a cotton farming village, was put together by director Susanna Magani. She'll be coming to Cannes, and she speaks for many in the Sudanese filmmaking community in lamenting warfare breaking out and the impact it's having on cinema in Sudan.
It's absolutely destructive. I mean, filmmakers already in the last few years have been working under really adverse conditions, but their lives weren't in danger. Now lives are in danger. And so there's no way in, there's no way out of Sudan. I'm supposed to go this year to make my first feature film, Cotton Queen, to Sudan, and that's impossible. So I'm going to now look for another country to approximate Sudan, which is really not what I wanted to do, but this is what we're forced to do, to take the industry elsewhere.
But what Sudanese filmmakers can take some comfort in, especially Mohamed Kordofani, is that there's been a lot of media coverage of his picture, both in the American film industry trade publications and general press. While Goodbye Julia may be generating a lot of interest in Cannes, Mohamed Kordofani wonders if it will ever be seen by people in Sudan.
For me, if the bombing stops, if just they just stop firing, I can go back and just screen the film in these deserted cinema halls.
Mohamed Kordofani ending that report from Tom Brooks in Cannes. It is 80 years to the day since the Dam Busters raid during the Second World War. On that night, 19 Lancaster aircraft left RAF Scampton in Lincolnshire in central England, armed with the newly invented bouncing bombs to attack the industrial heartland of Nazi Germany on the Ruhr. They were from 617 Squadron of the Royal Air Force, which was joined shortly afterwards by Wing Commander John Bell. Now aged 100, he's the last surviving veteran of Bomber Command. Wing Commander Bell was on the same base as the Dam Busters, and Michel Hussain asked him to tell us first about the sense there was at the time of what they had achieved.
It was quite a feat, we all thought. The squadron was formed to carry out that raid and, of course, had other raids to follow that were not at the same time. It was a remarkable operation.
What were the relationships like between the crews? Did you always stick together and move as a team?
Yes, we did. We stayed as a team the whole time. There were no changes, which was a good thing because you get used to each other and we all have got different attitudes to the war and feelings and so forth. On days out, we would go out together to a local town to spend the day. So sure, very much well linked together. The crew actually was picked by the rear gunner. It was a situation where all of the crews, air crews, were assembled and told to form up in crews of seven. A couple of us were standing around just waiting to see where we could find a pilot. And what turned out to be our rear gunner came up and said, "I found a pilot, join me, because we've now got a crew." That's how our crew was formed.
Did you have particular rituals, anything you did for good luck before you went out on a mission?
Yes. The rear gunner used to pee on the rear wheel of the Lancaster.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously, yes. He seemed to think this was a lucky charm. We did have a little lucky charm which we took on board. I think it was a fluffy dog. I think we must have found it in the hangar sometime and thought, oh, we'll take this with us. But you have to have a feeling of whatever happens, it's not going to happen to you. It was going to happen to some other guy. Fortunately, we were right. It didn't happen to us. We didn't get shot down.
What was the closest you came to that, though?
The closest was not being shot down. It was actually bad weather we were in. it affected the engines and they stopped working properly, and we were plunging down earthwards when the flight engineer managed to get them going again before we hit the ground. Weather can bring you down just as easily as anti-aircraft fire.
In the period that we're commemorating now, the Dambusters raid 80 years ago, the end of the war was still quite a way into the future. Do you remember feeling, after you heard of that particular success, that we can do it, we can win this war?
I know we were having a fair amount of success with our operations, which were designed to destroy the German ability to continue to wage war, in other words, to destroy their arms and submarines and other wartime war materials. And so that program had to be continued.
At the time, did you allow yourself to think about what civilian casualties there might have been?
Yes, I did. I often thought, while bombing a German city, I often thought about women and children down below, and just hoped that they were all safely in shelters, which I imagine they probably were. But it did concern me, but nothing you could do about it. We were attacking the weapons producing part of the city, or perhaps the railway yards, and they were specific targets, not just dropping bombs on the city to cause panic.
And what are your sentiments as you look back now and before that as well? Is it pride? Is it remembrance of those who aren't with us anymore?
Yes, it is remembrance. It was a job that had to be done. I don't have any doubt about that. There was no other way of defeating Germany but to take the war to the German production of arms and weapons and destroy them. And that was absolutely necessary.
An amazing man, Wing Commander John Bell, at 100 years old, the last surviving veteran of Bomber Command. Speaking there to Michelle Hussein. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham and the producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is ever Karen Martin, and I'm Valerie Sanderson. Till next time, bye-bye.
In March 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a massive tsunami. It plunged Japan into the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are at the war! An invisible enemy is trying to occupy Japan!
Fukushima, an original 7-part audio drama from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the heroes who fought to contain the disaster.
Our job is clear. To cool the reactors, you'll be risking your life to save Japan.
And of those living with its impact.
I'm connected to the disaster. I'll never be able to separate myself from it.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.